Welcome back to East Meets West. I'm Olga Bataman.
I'm Tara Reid. And wow, another eventful week has gone by and the Easter holiday.
First of all, yeah, we are between the two Easters, the Catholic and the Orthodox. But what I have to say that this Easter really has a bitter taste, doesn't it? Because from what we've heard from President Trump, on Sunday morning, I don't know if you're okay with that, but in our tradition, using curse language on the Easter Sunday, using words like hell, when he was warning to send Iranians to hell if they beep, not open the Strait of Hormuz, for us it's incompatible with the very essence, with the very substance of the Easter Sunday.
Yeah, it was shocking for Americans. And I don't care if you're atheist, Christian, you know, any other religion in the world, Buddhist, whatever. That was shocking to see such violent language. And Americans were shocked, both Republicans and Democrats. You know how the parties are divided, supposedly, in the U.S. There was an outcry for him to be removed or that he's lost his mind. He's also been unavailable to the press for a couple days. There's been talk about him being senile. But I'll tell you what, then a former cabinet member or a former person that was involved with Homeland Security said that in 2019 on Air Force Ones, he was talking to President Trump, this official said, and allegedly President Trump talked about crucifying migrants on the wall to show illegal aliens not to come. And he said he was so shocked. And, you know, he's no longer with the Trump administration. But you have people resigning. You have, you know, high up in the administration. This president fooled a lot of people when he ran on no more wars. He was going to clean the swamp. And then you see language like this and mocking the Islamic religion on Easter.
He was also mentioning Allah, and the Iranians responded to that because it's terrible.
It's sacrilegious.
But also Benjamin Netanyahu, he was congratulating Christians on the Easter day, but simultaneously, you know, he's obliterating churches. In Lebanon, like the mausoleum of Simon Peter was obliterated. It's 2,000 years old. And we all remember Father Peter, who was killed in southern Lebanon, who was killed while he was trying to help the wounded. And then the second shilling came and killed him. So I really guess that most of the Christians, they would prefer rather seeing their churches, their priests alive, than getting congratulations like that from Benjamin Netanyahu.
And having historic, that are thousands of years old, places of worship being demolished. Obliterated by weaponry, by Israel and by the United States.
Usually, Easter comes, you know, with a truce or with a ceasefire.
Or with peace talks,
It's something about love and compassion, but not about curse words, not about hell and things like that. So for us in our tradition, it's like completely incompatible.
It's been a really shocking time, I think, not only by the actions, but by the words. The actions are more shocking to the consciousness. The amount of people that have died now in Lebanon, civilians, children, women, the amount of people that have died in Gaza as a result of the genocide by Israel that the U.S. has funded. And there's no end in sight. And now, you know, the Iran, he said tomorrow, actually, so in the next day or so, is when he wanted to carry out this thing. Also, I think it was 9 generals were fired by Hegseth.
Yeah, it's collapsing.
Who were refusing.
It feels like the administration is collapsing.
Yeah, you know, as an American, I can say that I'm saddened. And it's very sad. But we have with us a guest who is amazing. He's a comedian. He's an author of 2 books. And I met him a couple of years ago online, and he was on my show previously in a previous life. And he is an amazing person and activist that has been standing up back when no one was standing up for Palestinians. And he really did to his career peril. He even had this sitcom that he was supposed to do for RTE, which is different than RT. It's RTE in Ireland. It's a Irish broadcasting. And it was canceled because of his strong stance, humanistic stance, in defense of the Palestinian people. He's been very outspoken and anti-war, and I'm so pleased that he's joined us. Welcome, Taig Hickey. Welcome to East Meets West.
And happy Easter. Happy Easter, Taig.
Happy Easter.
Although it's a bit of a bitter Easter, I have to say.
Yeah, and I got a bit emotional because it's hard being an American right now and seeing all this death and destruction. It really is. Yeah. So what are your thoughts?
I totally hear what you guys are saying in terms of the inappropriate day of using language like that and using a tone like that. But even aside from the expletives, I think on Easter Sunday morning, from the Christian perspective, or at least the Catholic perspective, to be just threatening war crimes as well, it just seems like this administration is just going further and further away from anything approaching what Christ's teachings were, you know, and it's a weaponizing of Christianity that I find really appalling. It's really vulgar, the idea that, you know, Jesus is somehow this kind of agent of war for these people, and there's nothing Christian about their values. There's nothing Christian about their behavior. Certainly my understanding of Christ was about supporting the oppressed. Christ always stood with the beleaguered. He was an anti-imperialist, actually, in many ways of his own making. You know, he was fighting back against the Roman Empire. So for him to be weaponized now with the agents of empire and the imperialists, I think is really blasphemous, actually. It's really against, again, the religion that I was brought. I was brought up as a Catholic and whatnot. Yeah, but I also think the bigger thing is, like, Trump's behavior. They've got a really difficult time trying to portray Iran as this backward country that's really repressive and should be put back to the Stone Age, when Trump's behavior, Hegseth's behavior, and the whole US administration's behavior, they're the ones who are acting like they are in the Stone Age right now. You know, so they've got a really difficult problem kind of projecting this propaganda that we need to again go into the Middle East and educate and obliterate, actually, these uncivilized brown people, when it's the Americans who look like they're the ones who are backward, they're the ones who are regressive and repressive, not just to their own people, but to people around the world. So, it's interesting time. It feels like we're in a kind of an upside down world. You know, every single thing that Trump says, I can't believe that we're in an age where the president of the US, whatever your feelings about presidents of the US all through the years, but that he would have this lack of decorum and basic kind of manners and humanity is still very shocking, I think. And we should be shocked by it. We should never normalize leaders of any country behaving in this really openly vulgar and inhumane way.
Taig, but doesn't it seem to you that, ironically, I don't know how history made this twist, but the Israeli, the Jews that suffered so much from the Holocaust, now... along with the United States, which is actually like one state, I would say, are behaving as fascists now. Doesn't it seem like that to you? Because even the rhetoric they are using, the superiority of their nation, you know, the Holocaust, the genocide that they are having on the ground, doesn't it seem to you that they are now behaving as fascists in their turn?
Definitely, but for me, it's not so much a Jewish thing. Christian Zionism is the most kind of voracious aspect of the Zionist project. Without Christian Zionists in the US at the moment, I feel Zionism would fall apart because there just aren't enough Jewish Zionists to kind of drive the movement forward.
Right.
It's about the evangelical Christians, I think, in the US are the most vulgar. And the most blasphemous. Again, I mean, people who are an awful lot more educated on this than I am would say that it's a heresy to believe that, first of all, that 1948 Israel is somehow biblical Israel. Like, there's no connection between the two at all. Mm. And that the Christian Zionist belief that Jesus is going to come back and all the Christians are going to be like pulled up into heaven, and they're going to be having a great day, and all the Jews who don't immediately convert to Christianity are going to be smited and they're going to be murdered. Like, what a bizarre way to show allyship to the Jewish people, saying that we support you, but only because it's going to bring back our God, and if you don't convert, you're dead. Like, the whole thing is, as a satirist, I find the just the lay of the land at the moment just beyond parody. It's almost impossible to mock it, because it's mocking itself so kind of elegantly, you know?
But I cannot imagine how people whose at least their great fathers, their grandfathers, maybe survived the Holocaust, and now they're using the same methods, like in Lebanon. You remember we discussed it with Steve Sweeney. They're using concentrated herbicides, for example. You know, these methods that the Nazis were using. Mm-hmm. And how come people who should remember the terrible episodes in the history that they went through and probably survived, and now they're doing the same and even being proud of that. Remember the Minister of Social, I think it was Social Justice of Israel, who said she was proud of the Holocaust in Gaza. Mm. She was openly saying she was proud of the Holocaust that Israel did in Gaza.
And you know, and to that, I wanted to ask you, because you actually, speaking of Gaza, you actually went on the flotilla with Greta Thunberg. Was that a year ago now already?
August. August, September.
Okay. And you watched and were around firsthand the hostility from the Israeli soldiers. Could you describe, you know, what you experienced and why you went?
Yeah, like, I mean, try and give you a succinct answer. Like, it felt like you were around people who are so drunk on their own farts of impunity that they just don't believe there are going to be any repercussions for anything they do, you know? Like, I can understand the way they treat Palestinians the way they do, because particularly the Western world has given up on even trying to see Palestinians as human beings. Like, you can do whatever you want to Palestinians and Lebanese, as you say. I mean, Israel is trying to conquer about 10% of Lebanon at the moment, and it barely makes the mainstream news here at all. Like, it's like it doesn't matter because they're only Lebanese. But because we're from Ireland, the US, Italy, you know, places where you'd imagine we'd have passports that would give us some sort of privilege, I couldn't believe that we were just like abducted in international waters, brought to a terrorist prison, which is what Ben-Gvir threatened. We were put into like prisoner garb, denied medical attention, denied contact with the outside world, no access to lawyers, no yard time. We were told to drink the water in our cells. There was no like running water, no bottled water. One of our comrades, an Irish guy, was 75 years of age, and he needed his insulin, and he was denied access to his insulin. He was in a cell, like kind of dying for 3 or 4 days without his insulin. It's a miracle he survived. I don't think they would have actually tried to kill one of us, but if one of us died in one of their cells, that would have been a big bonus, because it would have been a big deterrent for people going again. So I just think this country has enjoyed a level of impunity that I almost understand in a twisted, dark way why it continues doing atrocities. It just continues going for it. It's a matter of survival. It needs to like claim as much land as it can. It needs to murder as many people from the Levant as possible. And they're running out of time, because I don't think they feel like they're not going to get away with this for much longer. As long as Trump is in the White House, they're going to get away with pretty much everything they want. That's why they've got their desired war with Iran that they've tried to be. I think Netanyahu's been agitating for war with Iran for certainly 30 years, if not more, telling us that any moment now they're going to have weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons. Where have we heard that before? And I feel like Israel is just going to continue doing what it wants until there is meaningful pushback. I don't know about you guys, but I can't believe we're 2.5 years into what I would describe as a Holocaust in Gaza. Mm-hmm. They are claiming land in Lebanon. They have forced the US's hand into a war with Iran. And yet, what is the pushback? What is the pushback on Israel? They haven't been even so much as taken out of international football competition. Russia, I think, has been banned from international football for what, 4 or 5 years?
For most of the Olympics and all of the contests and the sanctions gone. And everything.
Yes, the Eurovision gone. And so it's the kind of exceptionalism around Israel, I feel, has really destroyed the so-called rules-based order. And we're seeing that again now in the case of Iran, where we have to, when Iran strikes back, we have to get really pious about it and say, oh my God, they're cluster munitions, they might be targeting civilians in Israel. And we're supposed to, in the collective West, be really concerned about American pilots and Israeli civilians. But again, they can murder as many people as they want in the Levant. And we all have to just go, that's just the way it is. That's just what happens when Israel exists in this world. We just have to support them no matter what they do.
Tag, but can you tell us about this Samud Flotilla? What were you bringing there? Did you manage to deliver the goods that you were bringing? Why they stopped you? I doubt you were bringing missiles or something like that in the tiny ships. I saw the video that the ships were really tiny and you were almost sitting on each other's knees. So I doubt you would be bringing nuclear bombs or something, right?
Well, certainly not. But unfortunately, as you guys know, we're living in a kind of a, I would say, a post-truth era. So it kind of doesn't matter what you're really doing. The propaganda from the US and Israel particularly will say that you are criminals, that you are bringing munitions. So like it was amusing to me. Myself and Greta made a video on our boat, and the point of the video was, I mean, it was a spoof to say, look at these bloodthirsty terrorists on this boat, you know, because we were described as Hamas, and we were going around the boat and there'd be one set of people playing like a board game, someone else is cooking. Like, these are all humanitarians, nobody has any criminal record, and we showed all the aid that we had on our boat. But when our boat was intercepted by the Israelis, they then destroyed all of our aid and made a video showing that we had no aid on the boat.
I saw those reports. Yeah, the reports were saying, the official reports of the Israelis were saying that there was no aid found in the boat.
Yeah, but I had already made videos. I mean, my boat, I think, was like the largest boat. I'm not saying it's my boat, I don't own the boat. But the boat that I was on had a lot of aid, and we made a video. And then 2 weeks later, Israel made another video saying, oh, look, they had no aid. So do you know what I mean? It kind of doesn't matter.
For their base, they just lie.
Real life doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But for our viewers who may not know, it seems that 2 million of people are blocked there in Gaza. They're isolated there. Yeah. Almost all of their hospitals are destroyed.
Yeah.
I remember there were very few left, and recently just the last ones were destroyed. So people have no access to medical aid, and they cannot leave if they need to get some medical aid. They cannot leave because Israel precludes them from leaving the country. So isn't it a genocide that people cannot get medical aid inside the country? Neither can they go abroad and get it abroad.
Of course. And I mean, I think like all legal experts that I know of, all genocide scholars, a plethora of human rights organizations, including human rights organizations in Israel, have described it as a genocide. But again, in the post-truth era, you just have a few Zionist activists on the internet saying, no, it's not a genocide and it's a blood libel to say that. And they probably have as much traction as people who've studied genocide their whole careers. So I think there's something about Trump, I think, as well, the figure of Trump, he kind of signifies for me the end of law and order, the end of academia, the end of trusted sources. It's like the kind of buffoon who enters the stage just before the theater is about to go up in flames, I think. That's the type of guy he is. And I think he's been emboldened by Israel's ability to say, I know what you've seen with your eyes and your ears. I know the clips that you've seen on your phone. We all have access to the internet, really. We've all seen what Israel has done the last 2 years, but actually what you're seeing, it's not correct. And you're anti-Semitic if you say that it is correct. And I think Trump has been emboldened by the sheer brazenness of Israel. I feel as well Trump saw what Israel has done in the last couple of years and thought to himself, I want in on this. They just go and bomb everywhere they want. Like, they just do what they want. They kill people, they take land, and they take their resources. That's America's thing. We need to get back in on that. I feel like Israel has created Trump 2.0 monster. A lot of the Venezuelans, a lot of what's going on in Iran right now, he's thinking to himself, well, the Israelis are getting away with it. We're their main sponsors. We need to get in on some of this action as well.
That's a really interesting perspective. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. And it is difficult to watch. Well, we're watching a shift of the world is now becoming multipolar. Obviously, so we're watching the last gasp of Western hegemony, so to speak. But what You had gone to Iran and Lebanon, I think, last year. Could you describe the Iran you saw pre, this is before the U.S. started bombing?
I spent maybe about a week in Tehran, so it's really hard to get a great sense of the country then when it's so vast. And actually, since I've come back, I've met a lot of people from different cities, and I actually can't wait to go back. And I hope that there's something left of the country, the way that Trump is threatening to commit like more massacres and more war crimes and to destroy more heritage sites. I find it bewildering that at the start of this war, the US was talking about liberating the people of Iran. And I think it's bombed like about 900 schools, various mm-hmm. hospitals, heritage sites. But from what I saw in Tehran, it's an extraordinarily beautiful place with a rich, rich thousands of years history of culture and art. And the people are really proud. The people certainly that I met take pride in the fact that their country has stood as a bulwark against US imperialism. And I think the sense I got from the people there and speaking, you know, with just regular Iranians on the street is that they feel like because of the sanctions, they've been put into a corner, and they take pride in the fact that they've basically reverse engineered their whole economy. And they're aware that no matter what the West says, that it's supposedly trying to liberate women and that they're appalled at the human rights atrocities that are supposedly going on in Iran. And I'm sure that the Iranian government has been very repressive towards its own citizens at certain points in history. But I think you have to understand the sanctions kind of role in that. Like, if your country is crawling with Mossad agents and CIA agents who are trying to take your country down, if it's being sanctioned within an inch of its life, then obviously there's going to have to be a degree of repression. And that aspect of the story is always missing from the West. But I do think they feel like it's not so much about the West trying to liberate them. If they really wanted to liberate them, they would relieve the sanctions. And if they were really so determined to free the people because they had concerns about human rights, why are they allies with Saudi Arabia? Like, Saudi Arabia has the most brutal human rights record probably on earth for decades, but the West are good friends with them because they play ball with the West. So the problem with Iran is
it's a universal pretext for the United States. The human rights has been a pretext for ages. So, if they wanted to liberate people, they wouldn't bomb elementary schools, you know, with 170 girls dying there and their hospitals and things like that. So, and we all see that in Iran, after Ayatollah was assassinated, brutally assassinated, he was not even hiding. All the people went into the street to support the new Ayatollah. So the regime didn't collapse what the United States was hoping for. Far from that. I think it's even more united than ever.
But I think we all realize at this point the problem with Iran is that it has supported Palestine to its own detriment. That's the whole problem with Iran, and that it will not cower to the US and Israel. I mean, like, you just look at the map. The countries that cower to the US and Israel, they're never described as regimes. They're never dictatorships. We never talk about their human rights record. I mean, there's a horrific human rights record in Bahrain. Look at what the UAE is doing all over the world. Again, Saudi Arabia. These countries are A-OK because they do deals with the West. Iran has fought back. It has not cowered, and it's not on its knees begging for crumbs from the king's table. That's why they're in the eye of the storm, not because of human rights. And as you quite rightly say, if the West cared about liberating the women of Iran, it probably wouldn't have massacred near 200 schoolgirls in Manab at the very start of this illegal war.
But don't you think that it smells to me as legalization of fascism nowadays in the world? And they do it deliberately on purpose. For example, you know, they are glorifying Bandera in Ukraine. So, like, to support those who commit do the coup d'etat.
Nazi.
Yeah, they support the Nazis, actually. Bandera was aligning with the Nazi. He was a Nazi himself. So, Navalny, as you know, who was called an opposition leader, but he was not a leader of anything. He was not a leader of any opposition. He was a Nazi. He was calling his compatriots from Asian republics cockroaches. He was a pure Nazi. So to shake his hand the Europeans, they have to justify the fascism. They have to legalize it somehow. So that's why it seems to me that that's what's happening in Europe, in the United States, what Israel is doing in the Middle East. It seems to be, for me, legalization of fascism. Maybe you would disagree, I don't know.
No, that's a really nice, that's a really interesting way of putting it. I mean, I feel there's a thing going on here in the West as well, where they're really like they're hedging their bets on the fact that the average person won't do any independent reading outside of what they're telling you. So, I mean, I'm sure Tara knows this, but I have always been shocked at how ingrained it is in the West, even in Ireland, believe it or not, that kind of Russia, Iran, China. Now, China's coming in from the cold a little bit because you can see the Europeans particularly are looking at China going, we need to make a few deals here. So we're going to forget about any of our human rights concerns about China. Like, but Russia certainly and Iran, these countries are just, you know, irredeemably evil. And so whatever the West is doing in its fight against these countries, we have to just go along with it. Okay, schoolgirls are going to get killed. You know, like millions of soldiers in Ukraine and Russia are going to die. But that's all OK, because Russia, we still have a kind of a Rocky 4 or 5 mentality about Russia here, like in the West, that basically the US is the good guy and Russia is the bad guy. And that's like propaganda is a hell of a drug. You know what I mean? Yeah. You always have to remember that. I mean, in Ireland, you laugh at this, but in Ireland, there are people writing articles almost every week in Sunday papers telling us about the threat of Russia. That Russia are coming, Ireland is probably going to have to throw away its neutrality. We're going to have to, we've got a triple lock here and they want to remove the triple lock, which is a kind of a, it kind of protects our neutrality basically. And the next step then will be joining NATO. Now, it's also laughable that NATO mightn't be a thing by the time that Ireland gets around to joining.
By the time Ireland, yeah. A little late to
but
the show there.
I always tell people here, yeah. I'm just not sure if the Russians are kind of thinking about Ireland. Like, I'm not sure if we're on their menu. But
I can say we are, and we do admire you as freedom seekers, honestly. And I think in one of your videos, you said that the reason why you went on this flotilla to Gaza, because I mean it was a risky endeavor actually. Yeah. So why you went there is partly, to an extent, due to the fact that you consider Irish to be like similar to those colonized by Britain. Yeah. In Europe, so it's not like European country colonizing some country across the ocean, but it's colonization happening inside Europe. So can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yes, of course. Well, I mean, I think Ireland has always had a unique position because of, as you rightly say, we were colonized by Britain before they went and did their colonizing around the rest of the world. We were literally the test case. Yeah. And all the colonial playbook that Britain used in Africa, in West Asia, wherever you want, that was all developed against the indigenous Irish population, the same dehumanization, classifying us as subhuman. We were ape-like in a lot of their magazines, their racist colonialist magazines. They were manufacturing consent for brutalizing us the same way that the imperial powers do today. So I think Gaza particularly, but I mean, it's obviously spread into like what is potentially, we're on the precipice of a world war now. But Gaza particularly, I think, made Irish people really stop and consider who we are. Do we identify more with empire? Do we identify more with what the US is particularly trying to do to the world for a long time? Or do we identify more with the oppressed people around the world? And that's always been an easy decision for me. But I think more and more Irish people now are getting in touch with their colonial past and seeing that actually Palestine is Ireland in many ways. Lebanon is Ireland. And if the imperial powers of today could get their way, they would fully take over Ireland as well. And in many ways, they kind of have. Like, Ireland is so tethered to the US for our economic needs. You know, the big reason why Ireland hasn't done more for Palestine, even though the people have been great, but the government are obviously pathetic, is because we are kind of an economic kind of vassal state of the US, really. All our big tech and big farm industries are American, and we're scared that Trump will pull the plug on our economy. So we're at a real crossroads in Ireland. It's kind of like our bank balance, our economy, or our soul. And I think that is, Ireland is almost like a microcosm for the way the whole world feels. I mean, I think it's just incomprehensible that what has been done to Gaza is still going on in Gaza, has extended across the West Bank, Lebanon, and is now going on in Iran as well. And there's not more worldwide protests. I can't believe the US, we aren't seeing massive anti-war protests in the US. We see this No Kings nonsense, mm-hmm. which is effectively just like, oh, Trump is a baddie, yeah. as if Trump is just the problem. Trump for me is just the symptom. Where is the mass protest in the US about going to the Middle East to slaughter again, just like it did in Iraq, just like it did in Afghanistan? I can't believe that more people aren't on the streets. It's depressing.
Yeah, you know, and you make a good point, because as you know, in the US, they would have had the Democratic Party won, they would have been in doing the same thing that Trump is doing, probably sooner. And so there's no difference. Like both parties, there's no difference between the two parties right now.
Yeah, well,
and I think Americans finally, because of this event, are waking up to it. They've been slowly waking up to it. I think COVID was a big wake-up call. But, you know, I wanted to get back a little bit to your work, because I love your work. Satire, you make people laugh, but it's hard to do. I think this is really excruciatingly hard time to do satire, but yet you're able to find the humor and everything. And are you, do you get any backlash from your government right now, or from the UK government itself, regarding some of the activism that you're doing and the satire that you do?
Ireland is a funny case, because we kind of tend to just kind of like turn a blind eye to almost everything. So I don't get any support from Irish institutions, but they kind of just leave me alone. And every now and then, if I do something extremely naughty, like when I went to Lebanon, that was seen really bold. So there were a couple of hit pieces on me when I came back in, like the Irish Times, saying, oh, this guy is supporting terrorism, like, you know. Which again is funny, because it has an imperialist mindset. To my knowledge, Hezbollah is not a proscribed organization in Ireland, although it is in Britain and America. Yet they still described it as a terrorist organization in the Irish Times. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? There's all these like subtle colonial kind of imperialist thinking that we've kind of taken on. But like, no, to answer your question, the last time I was doing a kind of a fundraiser performance in England, the British police came to my event to ask what would I be speaking about. And to be fair to the organizers, they said, well, he's a comedian. We've no idea what he's going to say. Like, he doesn't have a script. So I can get away with a lot, but I mean, without going into specific details right now, I can feel that there's eyes on me a lot, you know, and there's people who've taken down my Instagram account, my TikTok. I've been demonetized on YouTube.
So there's pressure. There's pressure put upon you, right?
Yes, yes. And it's, I suppose, where it's scary is, like we were talking about off camera, like I have three kids. I've got three daughters. I've got three beautiful daughters. One is 22. And then I've got two smallies, one and three, which is obviously heartbreaking to be away from them when I was on the flotilla. But I now have to think about everything in terms of my kids. So before I had, you know, children, you just think, well, I don't care. I'm going to fight in the system. I'm going to lead a Marxist revolution in my own country.
Yeah.
And be damned with the consequences. But when you have kids and there's people, you know, I get threatened online a little bit, like, which again is a little bit different when you have kids. It's unpleasant. I'm sure you understand, guys. But for me, a lot of it is trying to dissuade you from doing what you're doing. So the reason why I've come to people's attention that they're threatening me or closing down my social media accounts is I've obviously been effective.
And
I don't think you should cower to bullies. Like, so I think where possible, I don't cower and I don't like apologize. Mm. But when people start threatening you and your family, obviously, you know, it would be nice if there were some protections out there. But I think we've all learned the hard way that you're kind of on your own if you're kind of fighting back against empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When you were in Iran, did you meet any of the officials? You talked about meeting people there on the ground and different, but did you meet any of the officials? Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was mostly because I was on a media tour, effectively, because I was there for a film festival about Gaza. It was mostly press people and media people. And actually, weirdly, at the event that we were supposed to have, it was supposed to be opened by President Raisi, and he actually died in helicopter crash, if you remember,
yeah,
whilst I was in Iran, which was absolutely bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'd literally never been to that part of the world before. And I think on day two that I got there, the whole country went into mourning, which was so strange. But I didn't specifically meet officials, but I was then present in Tehran for the funeral of President Raisi, which was genuinely one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, because it was me and maybe one or two other white guys on the streets where there were millions of people, and we were treated so well. We were welcomed into this really extremely sad, poignant occasion. And it was kind of the welcome I got from people in that experience that I suppose I'd always been aware that we're getting a lot of Western propaganda here in terms of those countries being bad and we're somehow the good guys. But I just thought, like, would I get that type of welcome as an outsider? You know, or sorry, if somebody was in my country or in the US or in mm-hmm. anywhere in the West, would you get that type of welcome if you had a different color skin and you were, you know, just happened to be there at this poignant moment? I doubt it. I feel part of the hatred the West has for a lot of these countries is because deep down inside we're jealous, we're envious of the kind of camaraderie, the fellowship they have, the faith they have. The thing that binds them together, their anti-imperialism. We don't have any of those values, so we really, I think, are eager to destroy them because we can't almost cope with the fact that they have what we would really secretly long for, which is meaning in our lives.
I can share the same emotions, because when I went to Tehran, it was a very brief visit, literally a couple of hours, maybe 6 hours I spent there for the first time. It was an official visit. And I decided just to go into the central square to buy coffee, at least, you know, to enjoy half an hour, you know, sitting in Tehran.
Yeah.
So I came to buy a cappuccino in a coffee shop. And, you know, I couldn't pay because the cards were not working. I mean, Iran, as you know, is under sanctions. So I had no cash because I didn't have time to change it. And I didn't have cards. And can you imagine the barista? He just said, OK, here's your cappuccino. Sit down and enjoy it. You know, he was not even unhappy. You know, he just gave me the cappuccino with a smile and said, enjoy your cappuccino, not a problem. Can you imagine? I still remember this guy.
Can you imagine that in London? The cops would be there in 2 minutes if you try that in London.
In London. They.
So, let us also ask you, since you mentioned Ireland and all these economic consequences, has Ireland faced economic consequences of what's going on, including the disruption of energy ties and, you know, disruption of all of the ties that actually existed, the sanctions, and now what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz? So how does it feel in Ireland right now?
Yeah, well, we have like our parliament here, the Dáil, which is, there's talk of them being returned from their Easter holidays early to talk about the fact that prices, you know, at the pumps are getting out of hand. But when that debate was happening, I mean, at the risk of being, you know, repetitive in what I'm saying, I feel like the way it's framed in Ireland is, here are the consequences for us, you know, so it's going to hurt us when we're getting our petrol and our diesel. But I feel it should be fundamentally framed with, people in the Middle East are being slaughtered again. You know, that should be our primary way of looking at it. And then here are some of the effects in our lives as well. Like, of course, I'm not saying discount them, but the way in which it's framed is like, you don't need to care about the slaughter. You don't need to care about, like, for instance, the schoolgirls being killed, but it's going to affect you, like, as a white person in Western Europe at the pay pump, you know? So, but yeah, I think that our immediate effects are just literally in terms of oil and gas. We have, the Irish government plays a really good role, I think, in just doing enough to kind of appease the general population, which are mostly, I would say, on the side of people in the Levant, Palestinians, Lebanese and whatnot. And it just tries to straddle this fence between what the people really want and then in terms of our own economic kind of reality. We can't be too tough on President Trump. So our own leader came back from the White House having delivered shamrocks, you know, for St. Patrick's Day to Trump in this kind of ceremony that happens every year. And the big feeling across the Irish mainstream media was that he had done well to deal with this kind of belligerent, unpredictable character that Trump is, and that our leader, Micheál Martin, had protected the Irish economy, you know, really well. But I suppose I and many other anti-imperialists here in Ireland just felt, at what point does the soul of your own nation take precedence over your economic concerns? At what point, if you have, which the Irish leader has done, has said that what's going on in Gaza is a genocide, I just can't understand how you could say it's a genocide and then travel over and deliver some shamrocks to the guy who is currently sponsoring that genocide, not to mention the Epstein files, not to mention what he's doing in Iran, not to mention his, you know, for instance, expletive-filled post on Easter Sunday morning. At what point do you say, enough is enough, irrespective of what's going to happen to our economy, this actually kind of, you know, besmirches Ireland to shake this man's hand and give him some shamrock. So I really just wish that we would put our souls ahead of our economy for once in the history of this state.
You know, I really feel that the Irish are similar to Russians, you know.
I have a question about that, about how you're seeing this play out, because you predicted a lot of what's going on. I remember we talked a couple of years ago about this, and you made this prediction, and here we are, it's happening. The progression of this. Where do we go from here? How do you see this war in Iran? I mean, the U.S. is obviously losing. They've lost the plot. And that's why you see such a bellicose message.
Oh, come on. They spent $500 million U.S. dollars.
And they want $2 billion more.
To save one pilot. And I mean, no one knows if they saved him or not. And it's not even the ground operations. Right. I mean, what would be the ground operation if... We see a cemetery of planes, you know, to save one soldier, and we don't know if he was saved or not.
So you've been good at predicting.
Yeah, like to go back to your, you know, when you were characterizing his Easter morning, or Easter Sunday morning tweet, or Truth Social, whatever he calls it, that also doesn't sound like the musings of a man who has won a war.
Right.
You know, like if you've got an expletive-laden demand of your enemy, but yet 5 weeks ago you claimed that you beat that enemy. I feel because the man has kind of no nuance at all, it feels like he's revealing everything. Like, how could you be that irate and how could you be that expletive filled if you were calm and collected about how this war is going, which, by the way, you won 5 weeks ago. So I kind of find it interesting to see what way it will go in terms of the Americans, because you are dealing with a loose cannon in Trump. I mean, I suppose we all at this point accept that there is an element of what, you know, in the Epstein files and the amount of pressure that Israel is able to exert over him. For me, I don't believe that's the full picture. I also feel like you're dealing with a megalomaniac. You're dealing with somebody who has, you know, gotten rid of anyone around him who's going to give him any kind of sound advice at all. And he's now just got the yes men and women around him. And if they don't continue saying yes, he gets rid of them, as we've seen this week with Hegseth and others. They've gotten rid of, I think, 9 generals, as you said, Pam Bondi. So if people are kind of, you know, standing out of line a little bit, they're gotten rid of, which, again, to me, sounds like a dictatorship. It sounds like a totalitarian regime that apparently the West is always trying to liberate people who live in those types of regimes. But I feel because Trump is a loose cannon, he's literally capable of doing anything. And that genuinely scares me, because whilst I totally stand, obviously, with Iran and Lebanon right now in their noble anti-imperialist defensive war, I'm really terrified for their civilians, because this guy's capable of anything. He's already slaughtering civilians every single day. So when he's threatening to blow up bridges and oil refineries and all these places, I think we should take him seriously. He is not bluffing, because he feels like he'll get away with anything with his base. So I don't know about the American side, but what I feel from my experience with Iranians and Lebanese particularly, and Yemeni people, is that they don't give up. They can't give up. They don't cower. It's not in their religion. It's not in their makeup. Right. And this is the big mistake why the war in Iran should never have happened from the West perspective, is because, of course, they're not going to cower to the US with... No matter what the US did in the first few days, I could have told them, and I'm no geostrategic analyst, and I haven't studied, you know, I don't have a degree in political science, but I could have told the people who, you know, allowed this war to happen, you're up against an enemy that just doesn't give up. They won't give up.
Well, it's, you know, existential for them. It's for their survival.
Existential, yeah. A friend from mine in Iran said recently, it's martyrdom or it's victory or martyrdom for us. And either way, it's victory. And I think that sums up their mentality. Like, they will happily die. And again, this is the thing that we don't have in the West. We can't understand that. We think, well, what if we just try and bargain with them or offer them this deal or that deal? Or what if we say you can have this trip to fucking Mar-a-Lago or whatever it is? But they're not interested in those things because these people have souls. These people have something to live for. So I feel like Iran won't give up unless the war is put to bed. They won't take a ceasefire. And importantly, they won't abandon Lebanon. That's my prediction. So what the Israelis are going to do, they're taking a pounding, and the Israelis will want a cessation of violence between Iran and Israel because they're getting such a pounding. They don't care about American lives. As many American soldiers can die and the Israelis will be happy. But Israel will want to continue stealing land and murdering people in Lebanon, and Iran won't allow that to happen. And that, for me, is an impasse. I don't know what the end solution to that is going to be, but all I do know is that the Iranians and the Lebanese will keep fighting indefinitely. They can take as much pain as the West is willing to give out, because they've always been taking that pain. It's always been this way.
Yeah, for
decades.
That's
what we don't understand. Right. Decades, be it sanctions or military actions. But I know for sure the Israelis and the Americans don't have the stomach for endless pain. They just want to win quick, win big, and celebrate, and that's it.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And we all remember what the war in Vietnam ended up with for Nixon.
Yes.
We all remember that. Yeah. So it seems that the situation is kind of
repeating history.
Yeah, the history is repeating itself.
You're a very creative person, and you've written two books that our audience can find, and they'll follow you. We'll have your information on our show, how they can follow you on social media. But you have some other projects going on. Do you want to talk about your other projects and activism that you're doing, and as well as comedy?
Yeah, thank you so much. So because I've been kind of hunted off a lot of the social media platforms, I created a new outlet with an activist and comedian called Nicole Jennes, who's brilliant. And she still has kept her Instagram account, which I'm very suspicious of. Anybody who keeps their social media accounts at the moment, I think, need to be investigated. But but we have started our own media outlet, and it's called Now, Not On Our Watch. Now Media or Now TV. You can find us all over the place. And I feel like just kind of strength in numbers, which is a big problem, I think, in the pro-Palestine side, that sometimes we operate too singularly and then they can take us down. So what I'm trying to do is to try and go in with Nicole and a lot of the other pro-Palestine community in Britain and Ireland. And we're making content and making sketches. We're making like a new satire show with the second season of that is going to be filmed in London in May, and it'll be out in June and July. And then we're also doing a live show, something similar to you guys. And we're initially starting in YouTube, and we've already had some incredible guests. We've had Professor Morandi last week. It was really hard to get him because he's in so much demand, but also he's in a bunker. Basically, like, you know,
he's receiving so many threats now, you know?
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. And again, no, I mean, for one more point in the Western hypocrisy, no condemnation. I haven't seen anyone in the Western establishment say there's a bounty on this man's head, $1 million to capture him, and I would assume kill him and torture him. He's an academic. He's not a soldier. He's not a combatant, and no condemnation whatsoever. But anyway, back to me. That's our new media outlet. People can, and I still have like a Patreon account, and I'm still allowed on X and whatnot. Okay. So if people want to support me, they can find me on X and whatnot. And I'm writing a show about my experiences on the Global Smooth Flotilla. That will be out later in the year, I hope. And other than that, I'm just trying to keep two kids under three occupied. Job.
That's who's running the house in your world, right?
Is the three-year-old. Can you imagine how hard it is to make people laugh and smile when the news is so sad and terrible?
It is, and I encourage our audience to check out your videos, because they do make you smile and laugh. You're able to find the humor, and I think we should work on that bit about Ireland joining NATO, but NATO's already gone. There's a bit there somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good. It's a good sketch, isn't it?
We got a good premise going. But thank you so much.
Thank you for your courage.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really.
Not at all, guys. It was an honor. It was lovely chatting to you guys. And good luck with the show. I think it's really great.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having us. And thanks for coming on. And we'll be following yours. So, and all of your work.
Thank you, guys. Yeah.
And by the way, we're having Professor Morandi on our show soon. If you have some questions that you want us to ask Professor Morandi and other guests, please send them to us on our social media and stay with us.
Yeah, keep watching and do check out Tai Kiki. He's amazingly talented, and you can get serious content as well as maybe get a smile in these really dark times. But for everyone, thanks for joining us. Follow us on social media. Please share us and please join our chat. We love it when you subscribe and take care. Peace out.
Take care. Bye.